So we're ready for our final installment of the 10 Makos, 10 plagues, after 2 years of working on them before Pesach. So this is the 10th plague is today, Makas Bechoros, the death of the firstborn. So I want to discuss what happened during the death of the firstborn and what events surrounded it and its significance. So this is the final plague, as we know, but it was actually the first one mentioned by Moshe to Paro, to Pharaoh. In his very first encounter, when he comes to greet Paro and warn him about what's going to happen, he brings a message from Hashem. And Hashem says, B'ni b'chori Yisrael, that the Jewish people are my firstborn son. So the entire Jewish nation is compared to Hashem's firstborn son. And Moshe tells Paro, in the name of Hashem, that if you don't release my firstborn son, I'm going to kill your firstborn son. And this is the idea of mida k'neged mida, it's measure for measure. The Jewish people look at Hashem's firstborn, meaning what? The Eben Ezra, one of the great commentators, explains that we are the first nation to serve God as a nation. Until the Jews, they're individuals that serve God. But never was there a whole nation that served God. So being the first nation that served God, we were compared to God's firstborn. So since Paro enslaved and tortured God's firstborn, God says, if you hurt my firstborn, I'm going to hurt your firstborn. That was the mida k'neged mida. That was the measure for measure punishment that Hashem gave to Paro. So this was alluded to from the very beginning of the entire episode of the Exodus, long before the other Makos. This is the very first conversation that Paro and Moshe had. So 9 plagues transpire. Yeah.
Did Moshe know that the 10th plague will be implemented?
I think Moshe knew. It seems that God from the start told Moshe, Paro will not listen. Paro is not going to give in. You'll have to do all 10 plagues. So it seems that Moshe didn't know from the start. There's even a medrash that says that Moshe's staff had engraved into it initials of the 10 plagues. Like Moshe was aware of these 10 plagues from before. So I would assume that Moshe was aware that all 10 plagues would transpire. He was supposed to, he went through all the motions to try to get Paro to give in. But Paro was a stubborn man and did not give in until the 10th plague. The nature of this 10th plague is interesting because it seems that it's not only to punish the Egyptians, but this one was meant to force the Jews' freedom. Meaning Hashem knew there'd be 10 plagues. Moshe knew, as we said, there'd be 10 plagues as well. The first 9, we've quoted several times, Hashem kind of alludes to the fact that I'm hoping that Paro will not give in because I want this to linger so that I can display myself to the world. Once the 10th plague comes, Hashem is ready to bring the Jews to freedom. And therefore, this 10th plague, beyond being a revelation of God and a way in which to punish Egyptians, was the plague which forced Paro to free the Jews. There was a whole lead-up to the 10th plague. And we'll discuss a little bit. I'm not going to go into depth into the lead-up to the 10th plague, but in between Moshe's final warning to Paro and the actual death of the firstborn, there was the commandment to bring the Korban Pesach, the Passover sacrifice. There are other mitzvahs that were given at the time. So this was the preparation for freedom, the preparation for being God's people. A lot happened in between this final warning to Paro and the actual death of the firstborn. There's a tense conversation which transpired between Moshe and Paro prior to his final warning. We actually mentioned it last week. After the plague of darkness, so Moshe comes back into Paro, and Paro says, okay, you know, I give in. You can leave Egypt, just don't take your animals with you. And Moshe tells Paro, I don't think so. You know, it's all or nothing. You know, I'm not compromising. So Paro gets very upset at that point with Moshe. And Paro actually threatens him. And this was really the first time we find that type of conversation between Moshe and Paro, surprisingly. And Paro tells Moshe, let me just get the quote here. He tells him, we were with Paro. So Paro tells Moshe, get out of here. Lech me aloi, get out of here. Guard yourself. Do not ever come to see my face again. Because on the day that you see my face, you will die. So that was a threat. Paro threatened Moshe. Do not come back here. Because the day that I see you again, essentially the same thing to kill you. That's what Paro tells Moshe. So Moshe says, okay, I won't come back to you anymore. And Moshe has the upper hand here, obviously, after 9 plagues, and has Hashem on his side. But then before Moshe actually leaves the palace, he gets a prophecy from God. And the prophecy that Hashem tells Moshe, he says, I'm going to bring one more plague upon Pharaoh and upon the Egyptians. After that, I'm going to send you out. Keshalko, Kala, Garish, Yerushalayim, Mizeh. No, he's going to send you out completely. He's going to throw you out of the land. And then Hashem says that there's going to be this final plague of the death of the firstborn. So Moshe then turns right back around to Pharaoh before leaving the palace and says, okay, one more thing to tell you. And he tells him, Kom Hashem, thus said Hashem, Kachatzos HaLaila, at about midnight, Hashem says, I will go out into Egypt. And all of the firstborns are going to die, from the firstborn of Paro, who will sit on the throne, to the firstborn of the maidservants that work on the mills, and all the firstborns of the animals. And there'll be a terrible cry throughout all of Egypt that never was heard before, never will be heard again, etc. So he warns him at this point, before leaving, about the plague of the firstborn. And then Moshe concludes his speech. He says, and all of your servants are going to come to me and bow down to me, and they're going to tell me, please get out of Egypt. And then we will go. And then it says Moshe stormed out from Paro in anger. So Moshe is the one who storms out in anger after this. And that was the end of their final conversation until the actual permission to leave. And that's how they leave it at this point.
Question.
Yeah. Okay.
Why did Paro want to leave, that Moshe should leave his animals?
Well, he wanted to come back.
Oh,
I mean, keep in mind, Moshe was requesting the whole time, not total freedom. He was requesting 3 days to serve God in the wilderness. He never actually requested total freedom. There's a reason why that was, which we could talk about maybe, but the entire time he was requesting, give us some time to serve our God in the wilderness and we'll come back. Paro didn't trust him. So Paro wanted some collateral. So first he says, leave behind your wife and kids. And then he says, leave behind your animals at least, you know? And Moshe says, no, we need everything. And he says, because we don't know what God's going to want. Maybe he'll want all of our animals' sacrifices. That was his excuse, as it were, to Paro. There's an interesting point in this speech, because God says, I'm going to strike Egypt at midnight. Chatos HaLaila, midnight. Moshe, when he reports that to Pharaoh, he says that God says he'll strike Egypt about midnight. Kachatzos HaLaila, about midnight. So usually Moshe is supposed to give over God's message precisely. God says at midnight, and we know God is exact, and God can be precise. And we mentioned in previous classes how many of the plagues happen in a very precise manner. But Moshe says to Paro, he says it's going to be about midnight when this plague strikes. So why does he say about midnight? So Rashi points out on that verse, Rashi says that Paro's astronomers, they're going to look when the plague happened, and they're going to say, Moshe was off by like 14 seconds or something, right? They're going to look up at the stars and look up at the moon at midnight when the plague actually occurs, and they're going to think Moshe was off slightly. And they're going to say, Moshe's a liar. Look, Moshe's totally a fraud. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He said midnight, and that's actually, 34 seconds past midnight right now. That was the attitude they had. And Moshe didn't want to corner himself into saying midnight because he was concerned for that issue. He was concerned for the astronomers or astrologers, whoever these people were, saying that this was not exactly midnight. Now, it's an incredible thing because this is after Moshe has certainly proved his validity. Moshe has brought about 9 plagues. He's predicted them in advance. He's brought them precisely as said. He's removed the plagues afterwards. I mean, it's very clear at this point that Moshe is a messenger from God who has the ability to bring about plagues and bring God's message. But yet, these Egyptians, if they saw Moshe off by a slight amount of time, would suddenly have an excuse. It's a very interesting thing. So what's the idea here? So, I mean, there's two, I think, lessons we can learn from this. Number one, it could be that Moshe didn't really care about the fact that these astrologers are going to be off by a few seconds. But Moshe didn't want to say anything that at all carried in it any semblance of a lie or being false. Even though Moshe was 100% accurate, if Moshe knows that what I'm going to say might be misunderstood by others, that's already some sort of lacking in Moshe's honesty, in Moshe's truth, in Moshe's speech. Moshe has to be someone who's totally true. Moshe brings us the Torah. Moshe, we say Moshe Emes. Moshe is true. And Moshe speaks in a way which others can misconstrue as not being true, even though it is true. That's already a shortcoming in the way Moshe wanted to present himself to the world. So that's one possibility here. Meaning, if anyone has any doubts in Moshe, even though Moshe for sure is right, God said midnight's going to be midnight. Moshe for sure is right. But any doubt at all in Moshe might bring the entire Torah into doubt, might bring the entire prophecy of Moshe into doubt. And we don't want that. So even though it's a very far-off concern that anybody's going to question Moshe at this point, Moshe had to be sure that he carried within him a total 100% truth and can't have anything said in his name that may be misconstrued in some way as inaccurate. Yeah.
You know, that, you mentioned that before, but that, I mean, that's great. So how do we deal with the three week? Let us go for what, three weeks?
3 days.
3 days. Yeah, how do we deal with that? They didn't want that. They just, that was not the truth. That they wanted to leave completely.
That's a good, very good question. Let me get to that a bit later. Let me get to that question later, okay? It's a good question. Yeah.
Doesn't the text say Hashem tells Moshe, tell Paro, 3 days?
Yeah. So that wasn't Moshe, that was Hashem.
Okay, so
Hashem also said Chatzos. He also said in the middle of the night.
Why does Hashem have to say that? Why does he say, tell him we're going for good?
All right. That's a good question. Let me get to it a little later. It's a good question. The other point is that you could see a lesson in human nature from the Egyptians here. That if somebody has their own agenda, they have their own belief system, or their own ideals, and they're stubborn, then any excuse they can find to reject what you're teaching them is very easy to find. I mean, Moshe, again, from logical perspective, Moshe has proved himself 100% at this point. 9 plagues, and Egypt's been ravaged by these plagues. People, you know, the whole country's in ruins. And someone's going to say, yeah, he's a liar. He's not telling the truth. Because why? He was off by 27 seconds, by 4 minutes. Like, but people can really fool themselves. You know, one little cynical remark made by somebody else, even if it's far off and ridiculous, it can destroy so much of a person's reputation, a person's standing. I think, you know, we're in the election season. They find it in politics all the time. You have a politician who, all in all, is pretty honest. He says one thing that people question, and suddenly this person is totally rejected, his reputation is shot, he's not elected anymore, people make fun of him. I mean, it's one little comment, you know, one word off when you're in politics or you're giving a speech in a campaign. One little word, even though you've proven yourself for 25 years as an honest, loyal person to the country, you know, but the press jumps on you and people jump on you, the other party jumps on you. We see it to this very day. If there's any way at all that you're able to uphold your own belief system and reject somebody else, even that person seems to be so true, people will do it. That's what a stubborn attitude can bring a person to do. And that's what cynicism brings us to do. If someone's cynical, they can be staring truth in the face, and they can deny it all. So that's what Moshe was concerned for. And Moshe says, yes, I've proven myself, beyond a shadow of a doubt. You know, and intellectually, logically, I'm 100% confirmed in terms of my validity. But yet, these Egyptians don't want to accept me. If they can find one slight little nuance that can somehow, you know, tarnish reputation, they're going to find it. So I have to be totally sure that what I say is going to be accurate. So Moshe says, at about midnight. And that's the way I think we can understand Rashi's comment. Now I'll tell you of another very interesting comment made by the Chassam Sofer, Moshe Sofer, one of the, you know, the great Hungarian Gedolim. He says that when Moshe says it was at about midnight, the reason he said that is because Hashem was working now on Israeli time, let's call it. And they were working on Egyptian time. So when Hashem says at midnight, he means midnight over, let's say, Jerusalem. He doesn't mean midnight over Cairo. That's essentially what Chassam Sofer says. So if, from the Egyptians' eyes, it will be off. They're not making a mistake. They're saying it's midnight now and the plague's not happening right now because Hashem's working on Israeli time. I saw somebody expand this even further based on a very surprising, I guess, comment made by the Targum Yonason. The Targum Yonason is one of the early translations of the Torah into Aramaic. And within that, he adds in a lot of, you know, commentary, midrash, things like that. So Targum Yonason actually says that when it came time for the Jews in Egypt to bring their Pesach sacrifice, they were actually transported to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem from Egypt. They offered the sacrifice there, and they're transported back. That's what he says, like an airlift or something. That's what he says. He actually says it on the verse that talks about being transported on the wings of eagles. That's where he says this. So, whether you take that literally or figuratively, but if you want to take that into account, that means that the Jews actually were standing in Jerusalem when this is all happening. So, putting all that together, you have a very interesting explanation. From Egypt to Jerusalem, and back to Egypt again. That's what Targum Yonason says. I mean, that's not usually the simple understanding of what happened that night. It's a very interesting understanding. But putting that all together, the Jews were actually standing in Jerusalem at the time when midnight hit. So if that was the case, then God's working on the time the Jews were working with, not the time the Egyptians were working with. Be it as it may, the main interpretation is that of Rashi, which is that it actually happened at midnight. It's just that human beings are not so accurate at telling time, especially in those days. They didn't have any clocks, no atomic watches. they had to tell time based on the stars and the moon, they'd be a little bit off. Hashem would be accurate, and they would find some way that they're going to question Moshe. So that was what. So Moshe said, "Kach Chatzos, about midnight, this will happen." Now I want to bring out one other point. You know, there's a big discussion in the Torah at this point about the Karban Pesach, the Pesach sacrifice, which is not today's discussion for this class. But I want to bring out one point from this. It was relevant to last Shabbos, Shabbos Hagadol, and the Shulchan Aruch comments that we have a practice of having a special Shabbos for Pesach, Shabbos Hagadol, and the reason given for Shabbos Hagadol is because of the great miracle which happened on that day in Egypt. What happened in Egypt? So God commanded us to set aside a lamb or a sheep to be our Karban Pesach, our Pesach sacrifice, and we're supposed to tie it to our beds, leave it there for 4 days. And then on the eve of Pesach, on the 14th of Nisan, you should slaughter it, you should rub the blood on your doorpost, as we know the story goes, and all the Jews enjoyed that sacrifice for their Seder that night before they left Egypt. So what was the great miracle? The great miracle was that the Egyptians worshipped sheep. So essentially, we took their god, and we tied their god to our beds for 4 days, and we slaughtered their god, and we rubbed their god's blood on our doorpost, and we roasted, you know, the Pesach has to be roasted on an open fire whole. So they took the whole sheep, and they roasted it outside on open fire, like a rotisserie or something. The aroma of the sheep, I'm sure, spread throughout all of Egypt. There was a lot of Jews roasting sheep at that point. It was done out in the open, whole, so it was very clearly a sheep. And through all that, the Egyptians did not attack the Jews. Now you would think that, okay, you know, you've done enough to us already, but you're going to slaughter and publicly roast our God? Like, that's unacceptable. You know, that's what the Egyptians should think. But God made a tremendous miracle, which is that the Egyptians, they watched and they stayed calm throughout this entire process. So that was the miracle of Shabbos HaGadol. Now, different commentaries bring out, now why did God command us to do that? I mean, why did God have us display in such a public manner the death of the Egyptian god? Now, obviously, we wanted to show their god was worthless. That was part of it. So we wanted to be able to take their god, slaughter it, and show the world, the Egyptians, and the entire world, that their sheep god is a worthless god. By the way, I believe that archaeologists have discovered little in these model sheep you can see in museums that the Egyptians worship. I think they called it Ra, R-A-A or something. But different museums have like ancient artifacts from the Egyptians where they actually had these little model sheep they used to worship. We actually have relics of this. So, but this should have been a death sentence to the Jews. This should have been, you know, essentially the Jews were doing something which was kind of crossing a line. No, the rest of the story was the Jews sat back and relaxed. God brought plagues. Okay, so you can't blame me. It was God. It wasn't me. But this time, I'm going out. I'm taking your God. I'm bringing him back to my house. I'm tying him to my bed. I'm slaughtering him. Then it's my fault. So the Egyptian slave masters should at this point be quite upset. So this whole process was a trial from God. God was testing us. Why was God testing us? Because God was trying to figure out, okay, you know, I've brought 9 plagues. I've given you Moshe as your leader. I'm trying to teach you faith and trust in the Almighty. Now, until this point, everything is passive. I want to know, are you willing to actively risk yourself on my behalf? I'm giving you a command. You must go out and take a sheep and tie it to your bed and slaughter it. So if the Jews have taken to heart the message of the first 9 plagues, and they're going to have full trust in God, they're going to go out there and get the sheep and publicly slaughter it and not be concerned for the Egyptians' reaction. Those Jews who didn't trust in God are going to be very nervous about this, and they might refrain. They might, you know, be a little bit too concerned for their lives to follow ahead with God's command. And this was a test. Now, often we talk about, there's two terms we use in terms of faith in God. There's emuna and bitachon. Emuna is more like the intellectual faith, and bitachon is, will I act on my faith? So, for instance, there might be a Jew who says, you know, I totally believe and trust in God and His Torah. But when it comes down to it, and he's given a choice, you know, either I want you to go ahead with this dishonest business deal, or it's the cost of your job. So do you trust in God that you'll do the right thing and God will provide for you? Or do you go ahead with this dishonest deal and continue in this work? Yeah. Bitachon, B-I-T-A-C-H-O-N.
Thank you.
Bitachon. But that's a question of action. Will I act on my faith? If people have faith, will I act on my faith? So God was testing us. God says, okay, I brought all these plagues. I've displayed myself to you. You've learned a lot about who I am, what I can do. Now, if you've taken it to heart, then you'll full trust in me. Then you'll act on my commands, even when it comes at a risk. But if you haven't taken it to heart, this is going to be very difficult for you. So God was testing us. And essentially, based on natural means, this is a death sentence. Taking the Egyptian god and slaughtering it publicly was a death sentence. And I actually saw a commentator point out a very interesting analogy. Because if you think about it, the Jews are ready to go. There's 9 plagues in. Moshe says, okay, this is it, guys. One more plague and we're out of here. And this was their chance. Now, they could really blow it right now. Because if the Egyptians come and they feel insulted by this, you know, taking and slaughtering of their god, and start massacring Jews, and that's it. You know, all these plagues have gone for naught. Now, there's no, you know, nothing's been accomplished because they'll just kill us all out. It was a death sentence. So the analogy which I saw was that imagine that somebody was in one of the concentration camps, and they know the Allies are on their way, and they hear the, you know, the Allied tanks, you know, pulling in outside the, you know, the forest or something. And at that moment, this Jew decides, I'm going to try to escape in front of this Nazi guard. So, like, if I wait 10 minutes, the Allies will be here and they'll free me. If I try to escape now, he'll still kill me, right? So why would I try to escape right now? It's ridiculous. I should wait 10 minutes and be free by the Nazi guard. So the Jews have that feeling. You know, if we wait around, God's going to take care of us. Now you're telling us we're supposed to take their lamb and we're supposed to slaughter it? And we're risking our lives for this? Why? We're going to be freed anyways tomorrow. What's the point of this? That was the challenge that they had. And but the difference was they were told by God, you must do this. Even though I'm going to save you, you need to go ahead and slaughter this lamb. That's what I'm asking you to do. And you know the Jews succeeded in this, and the Jews did display their bitachon, their trust in God, and they were freed that next day. But that was the challenge they were given. It was a very hefty challenge. Now this type of trust was required for the Jews to enter into the desert, because you know the prophets
Just going back to what you gave us a picture or two ago, the idea of when they were in darkness, a large number of Jews also perished.
Right.
So now we're in this 1/5 of a population state.
Right.
Still being tested.
Even these were tested. Because the ones that perished were the ones who had no chance. You know, the ones who were still alive were the contenders, I guess. You know, so now God had to see, okay, are you willing to display your faith in me or not? That's what God wanted to see. But they needed this, because when they went out to the desert, what happens? They go out to the desert, and the prophet preached to the Jews that, you know, you followed after God with no provisions. Imagine, you know, an entire nation just walks out into the desert. No food, no drinks, no nothing. And what gave them the confidence to do that? Trust in God. Because or else, as they think, later on in the story, they do complain. We might as well be back in Egypt again. We have that complaint in the Torah a few times. But when they first left Egypt, we say, Lechtech achreba midbar. God praised them and says, you follow me in the desert into an unsown land, an unplanted land. And you know that's. And I remember that love of your youth, you know, of your youthful stages when the Jews first left Egypt. I remember that love. Because that was the love and the trust that we had for God, which allowed us to enter into the desert. So if we didn't display trust in God in Egypt, we wouldn't have been able to handle going to the desert. You would have all rebelled against Moshe. What are you doing to us? You're taking us to the desert? For what? To die of thirst instead of dying under our slave masters? What's the point? So that was the challenge they had, and they succeeded. They slaughtered their lambs. They ate them. And the Egyptians just passively remained calm. They didn't do anything about it. They must have been upset about it, but the Egyptian God did not allow the Egyptians to at all hurt a Jew based on this whole act. So that was the one point about the Korban Pesach, about the Pesach sacrifice. In the time leading up to the plague of the firstborn, there's another point which many people aren't aware of. It says in Tehillim, "Am lemaki Mitzrayim bevchoreihem, ki lam chasto." So the typical translation of that is that God struck down Egypt, you know, through their firstborns. May it refers to the death of the firstborn, and if the first kindness endures forever. That's what it refers to on the simple level. But the rabbis teach us there's a deeper level to this. That God struck down Egypt with the firstborn. I mean, the firstborns themselves struck down Egypt. What does that mean? The rabbis teach us that the firstborn sons of the Egyptians, they actually waged war against their own families. Why? Because Moshe came in and warned Pharaoh and all of Egypt, I'm going to kill all your firstborns. So the firstborns came to Pharaoh and said, okay, Moshe was right 9 times. No, I don't want to be killed. We have to do something about this. And Pharaoh said, I don't trust Moshe. It's not going to happen. He didn't care. So what they do, they rebelled. The firstborns, they waged a war at that point. They all got together and they started fighting back against the Egyptians in order to convince Paro to free the Jews at this point and not have them all killed out. Yeah?
The firstborn, too young.
Why are you assuming they're young? It could be a 35-year-old firstborn also. It wasn't only babies. It was even adults who were firstborns.
What is the definition of firstborn?
It was the first child. We'll talk about who was included in this, but the first child born from a mother or father. It could be that they're 70 years old now, too. Yeah, the Bechor.
Bechor.
It goes beyond that, we'll see. But it means whether it be the firstborn from a mother or firstborn from a father. Or it goes beyond. I'll get to that soon. But
was it only males?
Females also. Females also.
Then how come females don't? Oh, they don't fast because it wasn't an obligation. The fast of the firstborn Friday morning.
Yeah.
So females don't do that. Is that because it wasn't mandatory?
I'm not really sure whether based on the actual plague, many more should fast than do. I'm not really sure why certain people are exempt from it, but we'll get to that a little later. We'll try to understand that. Yeah.
Did Hashem say that he was going to kill the firstborn son?
Well, that's what it said in the initial warning. God said, "The Jews are my firstborn son, and if you don't free them, I'm going to kill your firstborn son." There is talking to Paro in particular, and Paro had a firstborn son, right. And he killed Paro's firstborn son. But beyond Paro's firstborn son came all the other firstborns of Egypt, whether it be man, woman, animal, etc. We'll talk more about who was included in this plague. But it did include anything that you could define as firstborn was included in this plague. So the firstborns at this point, they waged war against Egypt, against their parents, against Paro, against Paro's army, because they didn't want to be killed. They wanted to free the Jews. And the rabbis teach us that many Egyptians were killed on the eve of the plague of the firstborn, by the firstborns, because they wanted to overcome the Egyptians and free the Jews. They didn't succeed. People were very, very scared. Some Egyptians even passed off their firstborn children to Jewish families, trying to protect them. It didn't work. They died also. Very reminiscent of the Holocaust, and many Jewish families passed off their kids to non-Jewish families to protect them, which there often it did work. But many of the Egyptians did pass off their kids to Jewish families, and they thought, if my child's in a Jewish household, maybe they'll survive. But it turned out even those children were killed. So at exactly midnight not meaning 12, midnight meaning the midpoint of the night, going from sunset to sunrise, exactly midnight, the firstborns died. Some actually say that they didn't die on the spot. They became sick and died in the morning. Why would that be? Because that would enable the Jews to see their, those who persecuted them suffering. So it doesn't sound too pleasant. But that's, some do say that they only die in the morning, they are ill at night. But many say they actually died on the spot in them. Who was struck? This is what we were talking about before. Who were the firstborns that were struck? So it was a firstborn either from a mother or a father. Either would qualify. It's interesting, the rabbis teach us that many Egyptian women had extramarital affairs and had firstborns from other men, and their husbands were not aware of it. And when these kids died, the husbands did a little research and figured out, this wasn't my son, this was this other guy's son, because his wife had an affair with somebody else. Because again, it could have been, if she had an affair with somebody else, and it was this man's first child, then it might be her fourth child, but it was that man's first child, so this child died. So many women were exposed for their illicit relationships based on this plague. And the rabbis point out as well that this is another revelation of God's power. Because based on human methods at the time for sure, it was impossible to discern who was the father of each child. The motherhood we knew because you could see who gave birth to the child. But to figure out who was the actual father of a child, in those days they didn't have the science to do it, they didn't know. So only Hashem knew. So Hashem's able to tell who was the parent of this child. And therefore, the firstborns that came from these other men, and these women that had extramarital affairs with, these firstborns also died. If a household had no firstborn, so then the eldest person in the house would die. So let's say it was someone who didn't have any children, or all children had moved out. So the oldest member of the household would die. The rabbis teach us, even there was a custom in Egypt that if they did have a firstborn who had died, not the plague, in general, if a firstborn child had died before the parents, they used to draw a picture on the wall of the house of that firstborn child. And during this plague, those pictures disintegrated. this kind of melted down or disintegrated during this plague. There, the rabbi teaches as well that even firstborns who had already been deceased, their bones were unearthed by dogs during this plague. And the dogs were out there unearthing these bones. It included women, it included men, it included animals. Firstborn animals also died, which, by the way, that we have a lot of mitzvahs that pertain to firstborn animals. And that's really based on this plague as well. There's a concept that the firstborn of kosher animals has a certain sanctity to it. It used to be sacrificed, has a temple. The firstborn donkey has sanctity to it. Certain forms of animals have sanctity based on this plague. Independent of gender, right. Well, not for, I mean, for the mitzvah, it's only males. But in the plague, gender did not make a difference. If a firstborn from another country was visiting Egypt at the time, he would also die. So if someone's on vacation, touring the pyramids or something, and they're firstborn, it wasn't really a good time in history to go tour Egypt. I don't think it was, the State Department would recommend against that, I think, during the 10 plagues. But during those times, the visitors would die. And the flip side was also true. If an Egyptian was out of the country, and he was a firstborn, he would die as well. So whether it was a foreign firstborn in Egypt, or an Egyptian firstborn elsewhere, they'd also die in this plague. So this plague was a very far-reaching plague. The Torah says, "Ein bayis in shamis." There was no household that did not have somebody who had died. Every household had somebody in there who had died. So this was a major plague for the Egyptians, and this was the one which made them give in. The astounding thing.
It's kind of like the atomic bombs.
Yeah, it was so far-reaching, so destructive. I mean, in a certain sense, every plague was an atomic bomb, but this one, I guess, was the worst. Now, there's something very astounding, which we saw that many Egyptians actually were concerned about this plague. The firstborns rebelled. Some tried to hide their children. Paro, as we've seen throughout, was not concerned. The Torah records that at midnight, Paro got woke up from his bed. Paro went to sleep that night. Any good leader of a country, if the country's having a disaster, shouldn't be sleeping that night, We would hope that our commander-in-chief, if a war's breaking out, would be up and, attentive to what's happening. But we find that Paro went to sleep that night, and Paro only woke up from his bed at Chatzos HaLayel, middle of the night. That's what Rashi points that out. Rashi says that Paro got up, and Rashi says from his bed. He was in bed that night. That's what Rashi says. What's interesting is Paro himself, he lost a firstborn child. He had a firstborn child who was killed during this plague. But there are two firstborns that were spared from the plague, the rabbis teach us. And one firstborn was Paro himself. Paro was a firstborn, and he was spared. Why was he spared? Because Hashem wanted him to have to witness the splitting of the sea and the death of the rest of the Egyptians. So Paro was spared. The other firstborn that was spared, the rabbis teach us, was Paro's daughter, the one who had saved Moshe from the Nile, Basia. Being that she was Moshe's adopted mother and a righteous woman, Moshe davened on her behalf, and she was spared as well. She was a firstborn daughter, I guess, from one of Paro's many wives. So she was spared as well from this plague. That's the question. Okay, yeah. So the two of them, Paro and Basia, Paro's daughter, were spared from the plague. Every other firstborn in Egypt died. Now, what do you see here about Paro? Again, you see how stubborn he was. 9 plagues have passed. He can go to sleep that night. He's resting comfortably on his bed when this all is transpiring. Everyone else, there's chaos in Egypt. The firstborns are waging war. And everyone's terrified and crying and screaming. And Paro is having a nice sleep in his bed. That's what Paro is doing. Paro we look at as kind of the epitome of what we would call stubbornness, or the Hebrew term, kashe orif. The Jews in the desert referred to as a stiff-necked people. Am kashe orif, a stubborn people the entire time in the desert. Why are they referred to? But why is the term used kashe orif? So literally kashe orif means, they translate it as stiff necked. The orif is the back of your neck. And the Jews are called a stiff necked people. And commentaries describe, I think it's the Sforno describes, what's the idea of being a stiff necked person? So we know the neck is what connects your head to your body. The spinal cord runs through the neck. And the messages from your brain, they are transferred from your brain down to your body, through your neck. That's where it goes. So the idea of being stubborn, kshe orif, is the idea that, you might have ideas in your head, but they don't actually impact your actions. The Sforno, he actually says that being stiff-necked also means I'm looking straight. someone tries to teach me to go right, I say, no, I'm going straight. I'm not turning my head. I'm doing it no matter what. No one's going to change me. No one's going to stop me. That's being stubborn. No matter how much truth is thrown your way, no matter how many messages you get from God, how many miracles you see occur in front of your eyes, you say, I'm not going to veer off my goals. I'm going straight. I'm not turning to the side, even though God's trying to push me off to the side. So Paro is somebody who we would call a stiff-necked person. His name, if you rearrange the letters of Paro in Hebrew, Pei, Resh, Ayin, Hey, you get the word Orif is in there. Orif, Orpa, the back of the neck, the same concept. Because Paro is the epitome of somebody who is stubborn and will not change his attitude no matter what. So Paro, after experiencing 9 plagues, having the warning from Moshe about the 10th, having all of Egypt in chaos, he says, I'm not interested, I'm going to sleep. And that's what he does. He goes to sleep that night. So finally, at the middle of the night, when everybody is dying and all of Egypt is screaming out loud, Paro wakes up to find his own firstborn son dead as well. And finally, Paro feels a little bit of remorse over what he has done. So the Torah records, let's find the... The Paro got up in the night, he and his servants and all of Egypt, and there was a terrible cry in Egypt, for there was no house that had no dead. And Paro called to Moshe and Aaron in the night, and he said, get out of here. You and all the Jews, go and serve your God as you've said, your sheep, your cattle, take them with you as you've spoken, and also bless me. Paro says for blessing now. Paro finally believes in Moshe's validity, and Paro says, Moshe, bless me as well. And the Egyptians started pushing us out, you know, rushing us out of the land, which we get the famous story of the matzah. We rushed out so quickly, our bread didn't have time to rise. And we packed up and got out of there, basically, at this point. And then
did Moses bless Pharaoh?
It doesn't say that he did. I have no reason to assume he didn't. But the Torah does not record that he did.
Yeah. The Torah says that, but there's something in the Talmud where Moses said, we're not walking out here. They waited until the next morning or afternoon, and they walked out.
Well, the Torah says they left in the morning. They left that morning. The Torah says they left in the morning. I mean, the plague hit at midnight.
Yeah.
Paro called to Moshe, and essentially it says they left in the morning. That's what it says.
Okay, so they waited the whole night.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much night was left once Paro actually spoke to Moshe and the message got relayed, etc. But they actually left in the morning.
Something other than the Torah.
Right?
Something other than the Torah.
It's in the Torah. It says in the Torah here. It says that.
No, I can't.
Yeah.
I'm saying, isn't there another commentary that said Moshe decided that he wanted to not walk out like a criminal, but like a street escort?
He wanted to come out in the open daylight. Yeah, he didn't want to like right. rush out like he's hiding from somebody. He wanted to come out open daylight.
Right.
Yeah, correct.
Can
yeah.
you expand on bless me, Moshe? I mean, what's the fine line?
Well, you know, if
he has a revelation or what?
I think, yeah. I mean, Paro, he's experienced all 10 plagues. He's finally letting the Jews go. He's, at this point, recognizing the power of God and the power of Moshe. So I think at this point, he says, Moshe, okay, you can go, and I admit to the fact that you're a God's messenger, and you should bless me as well. I think that's what he's doing. I think he's become humble.
That he had his army follow.
Well, that was later on. That was a few days later. You know,
he changed
again. But at this point, he really sincerely, you know, admitted to Moshe that Moshe was right.
Bless me, and though he sent the army against you.
He doesn't know that yet. I think I mentioned a week or two ago that we do this also sometimes. A lot of times, you know, at the moment, you're totally sincere, and a few days later, you waver again. You know, like, I always mention, you know, when someone takes on a Yom Kippur resolution, right? At the time, you're so sincere, I'm going to be a better person this year. And a week or two later, you've gone back to your old ways. Were you insincere when you made that resolution? You weren't insincere. But just, you know, as time goes on, people change. That's what happens, you know. But Paro was totally sincere at this point. I don't think he was insincere.
He's also backing up on his threat to Moshe.
Yes, yeah.
Next time you see Moshe.
Next time he kill you. Right, yeah, he didn't kill Moshe. Right, he was very happy to send him out at this point. Not happy to, but he sent him out at this point.
Now, another question. On the side. Are there any archaeological,
what I'm aware of, I know there is a famous papyrus they found that speaks about the plagues. It talks about like blood and talks about people dying. I know there's something, that's the only thing I'm aware of. I forgot what it's called. Anyone know the name of that? Anyone ever heard of that before? I'm sure you can search it on Google. There is a papyrus they found that has in it a story that seems to resemble the 10 plagues.
That's a huge event. there should be a trace of it in the Egyptian history.
Well, yes and no. I mean, you're talking about, you know, so long ago. We're talking about 3,600 years ago now, something like that. So it's
famously, all cultures except the Jews never talk about their disasters.
They talk about their that's also true. Right. That's also true. And only the Torah records our disasters and our traditions, right?
There was a change of king, like the Hyksos. I mean, I think in Egyptian history, the beast that said that there was a change of kings came from Asia Minor somewhere. And then at a certain point right around there, the place where the kings came from changed.
Interesting.
I don't know if in Egyptian history they actually recount. I'm sure they say the Jews were slaves.
Right. Right, yeah, I don't know. But I didn't know that papyrus exists. That's the clearest archaeological evidence we have to the 10 plagues. Just, you know, running out of time, just one or two more points. One of them, there's two other points I want to discuss here. Number one is that we know in the Haggadah we point out that the death of the firstborn, God says, was done through me and myself, the Chlodi V'atzmi, not through an angel, not through a messenger. I do it myself. And that's what it says in the Torah. Ani yotzei b'soch Mitzrayim. God says, I will go out of Mitzrayim. I'm not sending an angel to do it. I'm not sending a messenger to do it. I'm doing it myself. Now, what it means, God doing himself versus a messenger, that's, you know, a deeper concept. More Kabbalistic, I guess. You know, what's the difference if God does or an angel does it? God sends the angel as well. But we... What?
It didn't matter in the first one.
No, it didn't make any difference. What we do see is that this is supposed to be kind of the climax of God's revelation. If God says, I am coming out here to do it, and I'm taking care of myself, we see the importance of the moment, and we see this is this is really the high point of God revealing himself to the world. Now, when God uses an angel, but in our terms, what that would mean is that God is sending, you know, other powers to take care of it. He's the one in charge, obviously. But it's like, this is something which I don't need to take care of myself. This is kind of beneath me, you know? But God says, I'm doing it myself. God's saying, it's not beneath me. This is what I have to take care of. This is one of the most important events in all of history. So I have to do it myself, to reveal myself to the world and take care of this important moment on my own. So that's the way I understand it. Obviously, there's a much deeper point there as well. There's another important point here, which is that it says that the Jews went and they requested vessels from the Egyptians to take with them. And it says that they found grace in the eyes of the Egyptians. Now, I saw some point out that itself was miraculous. If the Egyptians say, okay, I'll give it to you because I don't want you to kill me, we understand that. But say the Jews found grace in their eyes, like, oh, sure, I'm happy to give it to you. It's my pleasure. You're such a nice person. That's very surprising. I mean, yes, you know, you've killed my firstborn, and you've ravaged all my crops, you've destroyed my house, and I don't want to upset your God, so take all my possessions and get out of here. Fine, that we can understand. But to say that they were happy with us and we found grace in their eyes, that's very difficult to understand. But yeah, that's another miracle of God.
What's the Hebrew word?
For what? Chen.
Chen.
They found Chen, yeah. They found Chen. So the understanding of that is that the 10 plagues were constantly trying to reveal to the world God's power. So we see here God also can control human emotions. And that's another layer of God's power. The human emotions at this point naturally would not have been too graceful. You know, the Egyptians would not have been too happy with us. We twisted their arm until they said, "Uncle." So they, okay, take all my money. Let's get out of here, please. Don't kill me anymore. But they actually were happy with us. That was part of God's might to show I can actually tamper with the human emotions, and I can make them actually like you, even when naturally they should dislike you. And that's one of the miracles we find in the final moments of the Jews in Egypt. So these are all just important points about the final moments of the Jews in Egypt, the death of the firstborn. I just wanted to make sure one more pre-Pesach thought before we finish. We've had a few weeks now to discuss a lot of points about the Seder. And I just want to encourage everybody, you know, try to utilize the Seder as really a forum to develop and to deepen our faith in God, our emunah, our bitachon, our trust in God. There's a temptation just to kind of do it, but not to use it. We want to use our Seder. Take it as an opportunity that we can use this night as a night for growth. To learn for ourselves, to teach our children or our guests or whoever is at our Seder table, and to try to use it as a platform for discussion, exploration, and growth. Again, it's late at night, and there's a lot to do, And depending on who your crowd is, it's not always so easy to get all the ideas out there that you want to get out. But make sure that you seize the opportunity. It's a night which is set aside in the Torah, on the Jewish calendar, for growth in emunah, in faith in God, for developing a deeper sense of gratitude towards God. And it's well worth our while to take those opportunities and to use it to grow. So I wish everyone a kosher sameach, happy kosher pesach. Oh, okay, thank you. I forgot about that. The 3-day thing. So it is hard to understand why was the quest for 3 days. But I saw a commentary from Rav Sipsi Chaim Friedlander. He wanted to know, Moshe only requested 3 days to serve God. He didn't request freedom. He never requested freedom. He requested 3 days to serve God in the wilderness. And then they went off forever. The entire time, the entire story, he never actually requested 100% freedom. He requested, give us, let us off work for 3 days so we can serve God. That's your request.
Maybe Abduni, that's the whole point, right?
So, yeah, right. The Abduni, they can serve me in the wilderness.
Where can these be found?
I can't. Anywhere in the beginning of book, from the book of Shmos, you know, when Moshe comes to Paro from the beginning all the way through the end of the Exodus.
He requests 3 days only?
He wants 3 days. 3 days of freedom, right?
Chapter 4, chapter 5, somewhere around there.
Okay.
Can I
ask a
question?
Let me just address Phil's question first. So, the commentary I saw from Rabbi Chaim Friedlander. He writes that, you know, there's an idea that we want to leave Egypt in a way that we feel absolutely no recognition or gratitude towards Paro himself. If Paro had said, okay, you can go free forever, so then even though we know it was because he was forced and because, you know, God punished him, etc., bottom line, he liberated us. It would be like, you know, as it were, like our Abraham Lincoln in some ways. And obviously it was a little different because Abraham Lincoln was not being forced by God. But that's we feel very kind, you know, feelings towards Paro. We feel gratitude towards him because at the end he liberated us. The fact that we only said, let's have 3 days, Paro never liberated us. Paro never said you can go free forever. So then what do? We know it was all God. We know that we feel absolutely no connection or gratitude towards Paro. Our gratitude is totally focused on God 100%. But had Paro said you can go free forever just to get out and stay out, so then we would feel in some way indebted or feel gratitude towards Paro. That's how he explains. Yeah.
A Kabbalistic question.
Okay. I can't guarantee an answer, but you can ask.
Okay. Why in Bereshit there is no Lamed for Yisrael? Why there is no Lamed in Bereshit? Question number one.
Wait, what do you mean? In the word?
In Bereshit there is no Lamed. Second, Exodus is Shemot in Hebrew?
Yeah.
Exodus is Shemot.
Right.
Why there is no man in Bereshit? Question number two. There is no man. Okay. Number three. Why in Bereshit there is no Vav and He for Torah? And last question. Why in Bereshit there is no Tzadeh for Eretz? Why? Four questions.
You're assuming that the word Bereshit should contain all those concepts.
I would expect.
That's what you're assuming.
To find.
You mean the word. You mean that word. That one word.
I mean the Lamed for Yisrael. Because you have Yud.
Where is that found?
In Bereshit you have Yud, Shin, Resh, Aleph. You have it. The no lamed.
Uh-huh.
Shemot, you have Shin and Tav. No mem.
We know what the last word is of the Torah.
Tova. You have Tet and Resh. No Vav and He. I ask only tough questions. And He read them twice. But we have Berit, Covenant, and Shabbat in Bereshit.
Yeah.
Does this mean that the Berit, the alliance and the Shabbat are more important than Israel, than the Shemot, than the Torah, and Eretz? Is the question I ask. Since the Brit and Shabbat are in Bereshit, as I told you many times, does it mean that the alliance, the Brit and the Shabbat, are more important than Israel, than the Shemot, second pillar of Judaism, than Torah, third pillar of Judaism, and Eretz, the land of Israel? And are my questions valid or not? Are they valid?
Why don't you email me your questions? I can think about them. Answer down the spot, not so easy.